Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, then I was always running out of money, so I got a job in Louisiana and worked out there for a year on oysters and shrimp. Then I went back to Miami to get some more graduate work, and at that time then I was offered this job as the first biologist, marine biologist. That was in January of 49, and I came up here, and from here, then I went to Tallahassee, and I spent the rest of my time up there building the research organization that Florida now has, mainly in St. Petersburg. We have a big bunch of buildings down there, and about 70 scientific people. But it started out as one biologist and one laboratory technician in 1955. So they named the legislature named the place after me. We had a dedication in 1981. And I've worked consulting work all over the world, about 27 different countries, I guess. And I sample them. I couldn't give an exhaustive encyclopedic treatment of all that, but in my book I try to go into the cultures that I see and the nature of the people, as well as the fisheries problems that I see. And it's a sort of a piscatorial Richard Halliburton's Royal Road to Romance. I don't know if you ever heard of him or not.
I've heard of him.
Well, it has nothing to do with romance, but it was a bestseller about 1930. And I read it as a freshman in high school. And I was very much impressed by the approach that he had. And so I've built my book along the same lines.
What makes Apalachicola a unique area for oystering, if it is?
It isn't that unique. The reason that it's the center of today's production is that all the rest, it's won by default. All the rest of the primary areas are closed due to pollution. You had oyster canning plants in Cedar Key, you had them in Tampa, you had them in Fernandina, and there are records of shipping barrels of oysters in the shell from Biscayne Bay up to the northern markets, although I'm satisfied the production was never very great there because they don't have that amount of conditions. But you have conditions good as this, I think, in Pensacola, and they produce nice oysters over there. But it's subject to the damaging effects of urbanization. And Pensacola early went into the business of industrial genre that creates pollution. They still got it. They've cleaned up a lot, but it's still there. And Tampa Bay was a big oyster producer. So was Cedar Key. But now there's another factor that affected Cedar Key, and that is the seas are rising. And in fact, from 1898 to 1948, they had risen 3.5 inches in Cedar Key. Well, they have no embayment. So that meant that the marginal reefs are lying out where they can just barely make it because of high salt. They were destroyed by that because the optimum salinity moved inshore when the seas rose. You still have wonderful oysters down there, some of the best tasting oysters in the world, but the main reefs have been done in by this rising sea. Well, in this case, we had some suffering from that. Some of the peripheral marginal reefs have died because of this. The salinity just came up beyond the optimum. Oysters needing, of course, a mixture of fresh and salt water. Of course, we have the Apalachicola River and all that fresh water that has always nourished them. And then we have a mixing bowl out here created by these barrier islands. But to me, the greatest danger to this oyster industry is not pollution, because that's pretty well been foreclosed, but the continued increased use of the water from the tributaries of the Apalachicola River by everybody from municipalities to industries to irrigation, and just continue to use it. And as they do, the average salinity of the bay rises, and more of the periphery is lost to production. So to me, this bay is eventually doomed unless they stop that, and I don't see any way they're going to stop it. All those towns are growing and need more and more water. And it's basically dissipated when once they use it. A fraction of it ever gets back in the streams again. In fact, at one time, Atlanta was pulling water from the Flint. I think it was the Flint. Using it in the city for municipal water, and when it got all through and was sewage and they treated it, they dumped it across the divide into a stream that emptied into the Atlantic Ocean. Now, they tell me that's been rectified. I don't know if it has or not. That's what they say. But at any rate, the usage up there is tremendous, and it's causing problems with navigation down here. They have to struggle all the time to keep 9 feet. I'm trying to think of... There were a number of things that I noticed here. At election time, there was always a fish fry or a public meeting down in the Battery Park. And this is characteristic of this part of the South that I've been in. And everybody who's running for office is supposed to stand up and say something. And all the people that are there and milling around, half of them have had a little bit of a grape cup of cheers. But it was a big feature. Now, there are still remnants of that around too here, but not anything like it used to be. It used to be a prominent part of life here. Another thing that you might find interesting is the fact that this area was so sparsely populated that even with the gerrymandering that went on, that gave an inordinate amount of representation in the Florida legislature to these small counties, they still would have only one senator, say, for three counties. Now, in 1949, when I came here, there were no incorporated towns or villages in two of the counties that were linked up with this one. Well, this town was incorporated, and so was Carrabelle. But Wakulla County had no incorporated town or village, and Liberty County didn't have one until just recent years. Bristol is now them. So these three counties had one senator, and they all got together and they had a gentleman's agreement that one senator would be from this county for 4 years. Everybody, and you'd have candidates running from this county, but nobody would run from the other two counties, and they'd pick their senator from among the candidates from this county. Then next time, after 4 years, it'd be Wakulla's turn. And then Liberty County. Well, while I lived here earlier, one man moved from one area into another to try and beat the rap on this. And he got beat. That had something to do with it. A lot of people didn't believe in that. This was also true. Citrus County belonged in one of these leagues, which is Crystal River. And that man moved back and forth every 4 years. His name was Nick Connor. And he stayed up there a long time. I don't know whether he just quit or somebody finally beat him. But every 4 years he'd move his residence.
I know that the life cycle of an oyster is probably very complicated. Can you explain it? Just
not really. As the water warms, this is true of a great many animals that live in the sea or in fresh water, or even birds are affected by the length of the sun, the length of the day. The water starts to rise in temperature, and that stimulates the gonads to start producing sex products. And when it gets up to a certain point, one of them will leak some of this out in the water, and it has a stimulating effect, and that'll stimulate some more, and then that'll stimulate more, and pretty soon it's just a massive spawning. And the sex products unite in the water, form a little embryo, which quickly develops into a little bivalve mollusk that swims around, called a villager. And it'll swim a week or so, maybe 10 days in this warm water here. And then it has to find a place to attach. If it doesn't, it falls in the mud and dies. Most of them, that's their fate. But those that find a place to cement themselves down do so, and then they're sessile there unless a man moves them. They'll stay there for the rest of their lives.
Which is about how long? How long does it take them to?
Well, there is no natural aging that I know of in an oyster or in most of these animals that you have in the higher animals. You have aging in that dog, and you have it in humans and cows and so forth. But basically, I don't think there's any aging process. If there is, I don't know anything about it. They just keep on living until something kills them. And I have pulled oysters up out here. Single oysters have been nowhere where anybody was trying to get them that were probably that long. Huge things. Maybe 15 or 20 years old, I don't know.
You just told me that you don't know, but it seems like with the oysters, or the people that are doing the oystering, they have to wait till the oyster is a certain size and that sort of thing. How do they cultivate those beds, and how is it they get them to grow?
Fisheries management is very complicated. And they do a lot of things from a lack of understanding, and sometimes that I won't bother to go into here. It's too technical.
Okay.
But I'll start out by saying that there's no feral marine resource in the world that's ever been managed. That's a big thing to say, but I'm saying it. I'm on record, not only here, but a lot of other places. The reasons for it are many. The typical improvidence of human beings, they go out and take and take and take and not do anything to... Unless it's their own, they might do something about it. But these are public, even in dictatorships, and even under the old royalty regimes and all. They belong to the sovereign. And this creates a very difficult thing to ever manage because the pressure is political activities and all. So they aren't. Internationally, there have been efforts made to manage whales, for instance, and there have been failures. So this fellow was called a while ago, and he represents the answer to all this. He's the coordinator of aquaculture activities in the Department of Agriculture up in Tallahassee. And that's the only answer. We're going to end up doing what they've been doing in the Orient for hundreds and thousands of years, and that's growing most of this stuff under controlled conditions. So that's the start of it. There are ways of cultivating oysters. And there is great encouragement for private enterprise in some states. Louisiana has 240,000 acres under lease. That's a lot. And this place right here is getting 95% of the oysters that they process here from Louisiana. But at the same time, there's a law on the books which exempts this county from having any oyster leases. This is backwardness with a capital B. And there's no way. I've been working on it since I came here in 1949, and I've not gotten that far in changing it. So it's one of those things. Now, that you were looking for cultural characteristics? There's one. That is strictly cultural. You can't change them. They're going to believe this. They don't want it, and that's all there is to it. Well, you simply, the state owns the bottom, and the law's on the books. We have lots of oyster and clam leases in Florida. Not here. Well, yeah, we had, when that law was passed about 20 years ago, there were in existence about 8 leases already here. And since then, they've abandoned some of them, and I think there are probably 4 or 5 left. And they aren't cultivated to the extent that they should be. It's not part of the culture of these people. But you go over to Louisiana where it's part of the culture, and they whole families are involved in these things, and whole great big corporations, and they don't know anything else but planting oyster leases, growing the oysters and harvesting them, all with mechanical equipment, which is outlawed out here. Strictly a cultural thing, and I have tried, I have failed in other ways here. I failed to get the proper orientation towards marine biology and fisheries in the schools. Now, I've lost a lot of money doing that. In fact, I'm still losing money because I turned down a lot of consultantships. I was in with a bunch in New York, and whenever they needed anybody, it was just automatic, send me, and I was kept busy. And I stood them up 3 times, and they just got sick and tired of it. I wrote them a letter here about 3 or 4 weeks ago, telling them I was still available and all. They don't even answer my mail. I don't blame them. I stood them up. Why? Because it was an opportunity to get this thing started out here in the high school. And then after I did that and made the commitment, then they didn't do it 3 times. So I am very sensitive to the cultural influences and the power of them. Now, the state of Washington, again, leases are a big part of the life of those people. Out there, they own the leases. They don't rent them. They got a grant from the government early in the game, and I think they pay something on them every year. But something like 60 to 80% of all the oysters, and I think maybe 90% of the clams are produced in hatcheries, grown up to a certain size and then placed out on the leases. But this is a nomadic berry-picking hunting type thing that humans were involved with 8 or 10,000 years ago in Europe and have outgrown it. But this place, this is the ultimate backwardness.
So what you're saying is if a person wants to go out and harvest oysters here,
they can go. They have to get a permit. I think there's a charge for it, but at least they have to get one. And if they sell the oysters to somebody else, they have to get I think it's $25. That's just recent, last couple of years. Before that, all you did was get a boat and go. But this place is in very bad shape right now, and it's a lot of things it was decimated by two hurricanes last year. One came through here and did a job on them, and then the other one did a worse job. So that's part of it. And then the lack of fresh water, we had a lot of, what time do you have?
I have 25 till 12.
Okay. The water situation has been bad. See, there are enemies of oysters, and the enemies almost all favor salty water, saltier than the oyster likes. So the oyster is sort of protected because it likes the lower salinities that these animals can't tolerate. But when the salinity comes up, they come in. And snails are very bad. They call them conchs around here, and they drill in and eat the oysters. And that's one of the big problems. And then there's a disease that when the oysters are stressed, it's always present in the oyster, but when the animal is stressed and is unable to cope, the disease just takes over and kills the animal. Production out here is at an all-time low right now. They have to scramble to get 4 bags a day. And the price has gone up accordingly. They're getting about $16 a bag, whereas before they were getting $6 and $7. But anything that's processed is coming up from Louisiana. These oysters here have a very fine taste, so they almost entirely go out as the half-shell trade for the oyster bars.
What has been, as a biologist, your relationship to the fishermen in the area? It seems like there's generally some antagonism. Have you always seen that, or do you experience it at all?
These people are resistant to anyone who has any ideas that are different from the ones that they've inherited, been given to them by their grandfathers and their fathers. And this young fellow coming in here, I came in here, I had several strikes on me. First of all, I was educated, but more than that, I was a Yankee. And they don't, it isn't as much said today as it was then, but it's still there. They're still fighting the Civil War in much of the South. I don't know if you're aware of this or not. Where are you from?
I'm from Kentucky, but I live over in Gainesville. So.
Well, you go out in that country. So we go down to Cedar Key. I have some of the best friends that I have in the world in Cedar Key, but they refer to me as a damn Yankee. Now, it's in a jocular way in some respects, but there's a little bit of seriousness still there. And the other people who don't know me I really am a damn Yankee. Now, that's true here, too. I get this every once in a while. I'll get into an argument with somebody around here, and they'll say, well, what could we expect? You're nothing but a damn Yankee. So you're still, you probably ran into that down there. That's a good area. White Springs would be a pretty good area for this.
It's obvious in parts of
this. And these are unlettered people. None of them ever finished. Some of them finished grade school, but that's about as far as most of them ever got. And they resist anyone with any education at all, basically. That's how it is. I don't know the psychology of this particularly. Now, my father graduated from the eighth grade, and that's as far as he ever got. But he didn't have this problem. He was a railroad telegrapher, and he read Victor Hugo and all of the old French writers and all at night in his home. And he didn't have this problem. He didn't have any education, really. So, of course, he left home at an early age, and he married my mother, who was a school teacher. And that, I don't think that would have been sufficient, though, if he'd had that cultural indoctrination against education. I don't think it would have, her having had one would have made the difference. He had a native interest in history. He read a lot of history and avid reader. And he respected educated people. So I had that little model in my home that goes against what I see around here. I can't explain this.
Can you describe the oystering techniques here? The way that they the typical oyster goes out and
he has a pair of tongs. They themselves call them idiot sticks, and that's what they are. This is. Takes the mentality of an idiot to operate them, but lots of muscle. And they haul the oysters up, and then they sit down and they cull them out, little ones and dead ones off of the others, and throw them down in the holding area of the vessel. And they usually oyster one at a time. There are boats that go out with two of them, two people on there. And then they bring them in, and up until recent years, they just shipped them out full of mud and everything else, and they couldn't get any price at all for them, lucky to ever sell them. And they adamantly, by God, refused to do it any differently than that. I was telling them about it in 1949. Why don't you run them through some squirts of water? Clean them up. So we got some, one fella came in here from further west. He's from over around Milton, grew up in a little town called Baghdad, grade 11s. A very aggressive, intelligent man, came in here with nothing at all, and he and his wife built up a big business. I guess he's number one or two around here now, and there's a tremendous business. But he saw this thing the way it should be, and he started washing his oysters and having standard sizes and putting them in these waterproof cardboard boxes and keeping them cool and quality, raised the price. And he's built a business on that. Well, that caught on then with some of these other guys. One of them was a very... he graduated from high school out here, Donnie Wilson, but he's a very good businessman, and he picked it up and ran with it. He does the same thing. And then it went to all these people with any real business sense at all got in on it, and they've made some changes. But for years, they refused to do this around here because they had always done it, that shipped it out full of trash shell, full of mud. So there have been some innovations, I guess. But basically, that's it. And then you have the shuckers who stand all day long and shuck the oysters. And one of the reasons that we do so much business of shucked oysters is that we have the cheap labor here. Now, it may change because Louisiana has oil. You have a high standard of living and higher, and you have a high labor cost. And those people won't shuck these oysters. So it works out well for both parties because the Louisiana, oh, there's some shucking over there, I won't say that. In fact, a lot, but an awful lot of it comes over here because we have the labor, and then we shuck them and ship them out as Apalachicola oysters.
And they're really Louisiana oysters. How much percentage, you said, like they shuck 95%?
Oh, it's more than 95% shucked now. I'd say it's almost 100, probably 100% of the oysters shucked here came from, if not Louisiana, certainly Texas. Texas, there's a lot of Texas oysters in here. But our local oyster then, which commands a higher price because it's popular with the half-shell trade, I don't think anybody in this town shucks Apalachicola oysters today. They all go out for the half-shell trade.
What's it going to take to, after the storms of last year, and how long do you think it's going to take to revive the harvesting of good oyster? Or good?
They may never come back. Really? If you have a series of things happen, and there are many unknowns in this, I wouldn't